Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, why some supporters of reproductive rights are nervous about the future despite the passage of Prop 139 last November. And actress Kristen Ritter talks about her new book. But first, Arizona Attorney General Chris Mays this week sent letters to retailers and law enforcement officials saying it is illegal for non-dispensaries to sell products infused with THC. THC is the main psychoactive compound in cannabis. Mays is giving businesses 30 days to take these products off their shelves. If they don't, they could face civil and/or criminal penalties. With me now to talk more about this is Sully Sullivan, Executive Director of the Hemp Industry Trade Association. Sully, good morning.
Thank you. Good morning.
So what do you make of Attorney General Mays' directive here, basically saying if you are not a dispensary, you should not be selling these products?
Yes. The Attorney General's letter highlights the urgent need for hemp regulation. Hemp prohibition or prohibition of any sort, bans of any sort, traditionally have not worked. Regulation is the answer.
So do you, what kind of regulation, I guess, do you think there should be? I mean, do you think that regular retail stores that are not dispensaries should be able to sell these products?
Yes. Senator Gowin and Senator Ortiz introduced a bipartisan bill this year that sought to regulate hemp products within a regulatory framework that would create a $1 billion hemp market, create just over 10,000 jobs, over $500 million of taxable payroll, and over $100 million for the state through a flat hemp excise tax. So we're missing out on that economic help in Arizona by implementing some sort of a ban versus a regulation model.
What kind of products are we talking about here?
So anything, there's edible products, inhalable products, so gummies, you know, vapes, flour, drinks, for example.
Mm. And are you finding these at, like, specialty shops? Like, can you go to, like, Target or Walmart and buy these things?
You can't find them at Target or Walmart, but you can find them at big box retailers like Total Wine and more.
So ideally, like, what would you like to see happen in terms of making sure that people who should not be buying these and using them don't do that?
Sure. So through a regulatory model, that would include age gating. So you must be carded for 21 and over. It would require protections for children, labeling regulations, marketing regulations, and the sort.
And in terms of, like, the ability to do any of that, are businesses precluded from doing that? I know it's not in state law that they have to, but, you know, if you are at, you know, a Total Wine type place, like, I assume they can still, they would card you anyway for buying any product that has alcohol in it there. They're also carding people who try to buy things with THC in them, right?
That's right. If you go into Total Wine and you buy a hemp THC drink, you are carded. So the hemp industry has been self-regulating. So Total Wine and other retailers have been, you know, requiring IDs for 21 and over, selling safe products that are tested, that are properly labeled for consumer protections and protections of children. And that's why regulation is so important, so that the bad actors that exist within a non-regulatory framework can be weeded out so that the good actors can stay.
Are you finding that there are bad actors here? Like, is the Attorney General right that there's stuff out there that not just kids, but, like, anybody shouldn't be putting in their bodies?
Absolutely. She's right. Again, in a non-regulatory model, there's no protection of anything involving consumers or children. That's why, you know, we advocate for not hemp prohibition, which creates a black market. The consumer demand for these products are high. They are there. And so we need to implement a regulatory model as opposed to a prohibition model to remove those bad actors.
Are you finding that that there are cases where, like, have you heard of people getting into health issues because they've taken these?
Sure. You know, Arizona Poison Control has reported cases of children going to the hospital for accidental ingestion. So 97% of accidental ingestions happen at the home. Marijuana products have a similar situation reported by Poison Control, where there's accidental ingestion at home. That's why regulation is important. That's why education is important.
Are there restrictions? Like, do you think there should be restrictions on the types of places at all that can sell these? I know you don't want just dispensaries, mm-hmm. but should anybody be allowed to sell these products?
So within a regulatory model, it would require licensing. So retailers would have to get a license. Regulations that are proposed at the legislature for hemp include a 500-foot setback from schools. Only certain types of products can be used. You cannot market to children, must have, again, testing and things like this. So there are limitations to who can retail and sell these products. They have to follow very specific and strict regulation through a regulatory model.
Hmm. So given, as you say, that over the past few years, there have been efforts to create this sort of regulatory licensing structure in the state, and those bills have gotten to various stages but have not yet become law, given that you're sort of in this Wild West kind of environment, is the Attorney General's action the right approach, even if it's just temporary, until the legislature takes action?
So we don't think prohibition or bans are the answer. Again, it drives the black market. Regulation, again, would be the answer to that. So she's right. You know, she has a good point. There's products out there that do appeal to children that are not tested. And again, prohibition and bans, you know, don't seem to work traditionally in our history. And so that's why we have been urging the legislators to pass these regulatory models so that the Attorney General doesn't have to go at these retailers who are good people that have families, people that want to do the right thing.
Have you heard anything from law enforcement folks about how keen they are to enforce this?
I have not. I've just, you know, am familiar with the Attorney General's letter and what she's saying. And what she's saying, you know, is based on her legal opinion letter, which is not law. Mm-hmm. And so federal law, hemp is federally legal. And so Arizona law has to follow federal law if it's not as expansive as the federal regulatory framework, which it's not. So these products are legal in Arizona. And the you know, concern we have is that, you know, the Attorney General's letter and any kind of law enforcement opens up the state to legal challenges.
All right, I'll have to leave it there. That is Sully Sullivan, Executive Director of the Hemp Industry Trade Association. Sully, thanks so much for coming in. I appreciate
it. Thank you so much, Mark. I appreciate it.
A state House committee yesterday approved a bill that puts restrictions on what cities and towns can regulate when it comes to housing. The measure, dubbed the Starter Homes Act, for example, would prohibit municipalities from getting involved in home buyers choosing the floor plan, interior or exterior design, and amenities of a house. It would also set rules on minimum lot sizes, among other provisions. The bill has already cleared the state Senate and is now set for debate in the House, but critics are planning to offer some amendments when the bill goes to the full House. Doug Nichols is the mayor of Yuma and is on the executive committee of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. He joins me now to talk about what he'd like to see changed. Mayor Nichols, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for being here. So what to you are the main issues with this bill, and what would you like to see added on to it when it goes to the full House?
Well, I mean, first off, I'd like to see that bill actually have provisions that help make houses affordable. You know, at this point, there's nothing in the bill that limits who buys these houses, which means it's open to investors from across the country, across the world, really, which only drives up housing prices and reduces opportunities for Arizonans to own homes.
How optimistic are you that lawmakers will agree to add that? I mean, this is a bill, the Starter Homes Act, a version of which was approved last year. The governor vetoed it. How confident are you that this year will be something that cities and towns can get behind?
I guess I can optimistically be cautious that that'll happen. We've had a very difficult time getting good discussion with those that are sponsoring the bills and looking to try to take local control away from the cities. They're just not really coming to the table with, you know, compromising kind of language or approach. So it makes for a very, very difficult conversation as we're trying to be part of the process but not really being fully engaged.
Cities have, over the past couple of years, as these types of bills have been going through, been concerned about sort of losing some of the rights that they have, some of the things that they're allowed to do. Are there provisions in the bill as it's currently constructed that concern you that would limit things that you would like to be able to do as a city?
Very much so. It gives essentially by right zoning to a lot of areas. And what that means is the planning that the cities have already done, the infrastructure investments, all the forward-looking planning that we do as a city that we're responsible to our citizens for, goes out the window. Because if someone all of a sudden wants to quadruple the density of a neighborhood that wasn't planned for, it's not as simple as just putting in the right size water line and sewer line in front of your property. It's a system. So it's got to work all the way down the system. And if we haven't been prepared for it, we have no ability to be engaged in the process to make sure we're mitigating and we're utilizing the systems that have been invested in over the years in a manner that is, I guess, relevant. I mean, just that the systems can actually handle the capacity. So local planning is a critical part of what cities bring. And it's not because mayor and council wants to have control over the city. It's because the people are engaged in the process. Our public meeting process is the heart and soul of zoning. It isn't the mayor and the council sitting there going, this is what I want to see. It's a lot of back and forth with our community members. And yes, there's always the group that doesn't want anything built next to them because they got their home. But a good council can take that input in and listen to the greater demands, the statewide demands for more housing, more affordability, and balance those needs as well as private property rights. So the people in this new bill as it's currently proposed are removed from the process completely.
What is the situation in Yuma in terms of having enough housing for folks who live there?
We are in a good spot here in Yuma. I mean, obviously, costs of housing really are driven by not regulatory controls, but by the market, by materials and by labor. So those are things that are really driving the costs. I think the city of Yuma, one of our developers said the regulatory stuff is between 3 to 5% of the cost, as opposed to labor and materials. So, for Yuma, we have opportunities, but the housing prices are going up, and it's causing problems for those that are trying to get into homes for the first time.
I'm curious, based on your proximity to California, you know, we hear so much about Californians coming to Arizona because it's, even though prices here are way higher than they have been, they're still pretty affordable compared to what they have in California. Are you seeing that, given that you're basically right on the border there?
So that's not a new phenomenon, really, for us. That drove the housing bubble in 2007, 2008 here, where someone would sell a home on the coast for $1 million and buy four homes in Yuma, you know, and rent out all four homes. And so that was what was driving then. But we've always had that. We're close enough where people can live in Yuma and actually like the quality of life here, but not have to live in Imperial Valley. But they can work in Imperial Valley. That's very common.
Okay. And you mentioned prices are maybe not where you would like them. Are you finding that people are struggling to find affordable places to either buy or rent?
The market right now is a little bit harder, yes. It's also interest rates play into that on what you can truly afford. So as those rates start coming down, I think you're going to start seeing more affordability. There is an issue for those that are just starting out that they find an affordable home. But it's still something that, you know, as a community, we're moving forward. Our council, we've made about a dozen zoning changes and code changes to help developers as well as homeowners, have the houses they want and they need and be responsive to the market and what's going on right now. So, you know, Yuma Council is very, very active. And we just had a housing committee from the community just issued their final recommendations, and we're going through those right now. So there's a lot that we're doing as a local community. However, if this bill goes through, it'll just supersede all that effort and will no longer reflect Yuma. It'll reflect a generic Arizona city, not a this is uniquely Yuma or uniquely Tempe or uniquely Flagstaff.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is Doug Nichols, mayor of Yuma. He's also on the executive committee of the League of Arizona Cities and Towns. Mayor Nichols, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Anytime. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, what it takes to uncover the mysteries within and beyond our solar system. But first, if you live in Arizona, maybe you have a vague sense that many of the state's fruits and vegetables filling our grocery aisles came from Mexico. But what you might not realize is just how many of them do. That's how journalist Melissa Del Bosque felt until she took a trip to Nogales. That's where she met Yoli Soto, the founder of Borderlands Produce Rescue. Del Bosque's profile of Soto, which was recently published in the Border Chronicle, illuminated not only the quantity of produce that makes its way across the border to places throughout the U.S., but also what happens when that produce is not purchased by retailers from the produce distributors. Del Bosque spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman, and she said she wasn't necessarily planning to profile Soto when she went to Nogales. She was there to speak at a conference. But then, in the middle of her panel, something remarkable happened.
It was wild. Somebody came in and said, a man just dropped off a whole pallet of cherry tomatoes on the sidewalk. People were going and getting them and bringing them in, and it was like Christmas or something. You know, it was weird. I was like, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll go get some of these tomatoes because they look perfectly good and nice. And so I asked somebody from Nogales, like, what's up with this guy dropping off like pallets of nice tomatoes that cost, you know, like $6 at the store in Tucson where I shop. And he said, oh, you didn't know Nogales is like the primary port of entry for all the produce and fruits for all of North America from November to May.
Yeah, 60% of the produce consumed in North America comes in via Nogales. That's a remarkable number.
I know, remarkable. And then I learned about Borderlands Produce Rescue.
Yeah. Well, so tell folks what exactly Borderlands Produce Rescue does, because there's some equally remarkable numbers lurking in here as well.
Yeah. So I went down to Nogales to visit with Yoli Soto, and she's the founder and CEO of Borderlands Produce Rescue. And she, you know, born and raised in Ambos, Nogales. Her dad was a pilot for the farming industry. So she grew up, you know, in the farming industry on the border. And she saw, you know, these millions of pounds of produce and fruit just being sent to the landfill in Nogales.
Right. And when you say millions of pounds, we should tell people that's 250 million pounds, right?
You can't even picture it. And it just seems terrible, right? When there are so many people facing food insecurity.
Yeah. And why does it get thrown away? Like, what is the issue with this produce that ends up in the landfill?
I mean, that was my question. And she said, well, you know, the distributors, and these are the warehouses that are dotted all over Nogales. So they receive the produce and the fruit from Mexico, and they house it there, and they have contracts with grocery stores who, you know, they'll come and inspect it to see if it's good or not. And, you know, they may look at one crate of cucumbers, for example, and if it doesn't look good, then they're like, no, we're rejecting this whole load of cucumbers. So
if like one little packet of cucumbers has like, say, a nick in it, they'll just reject the whole pallet?
Yeah, she was saying, you know, if the stems are broken, if the produce is rain stained. I mean, Americans are pretty spoiled. They want their produce to look perfect.
Right.
And if there's any little thing wrong with it, it gets rejected. So then it's slated for the landfill.
This seems like an extraordinary effort, considering, as we were pointing out, this just mountain of produce that ends up in landfills. Again, 250 million pounds. I feel like I can't say that number enough. It's like if you can't picture that number, maybe if you just hear it enough, the magnitude of this will get through. What happens after Borderlands Produce Rescue gets their hands on it?
Well, they have their warehouse down there on Produce Row in Nogales. They have several programs. She has a program called Veggies Are Us, where they open up the warehouse and you can just pick up fruits and vegetables there.
For free.
It is free. They ask for a contribution of $5,
yeah.
but but I don't think you actually have to pay it. Mm-hmm. And you can get up to 200 to 250 pounds of produce. Yeah, it's wild. And I mean, because she was saying, you know, Nogales doesn't have public transport. So what she's hoping is that people will come pick up 250 pounds of produce and then distribute it among their community, among their networks.
Yeah.
They also have one where they're asking for host sites around Arizona, and they will drive the produce up to that host site, typically like churches and community centers.
Well, so Melissa, this would be an incredible story under normal circumstances, just the sheer volume of produce that, as we've said, is coming into North America via Nogales. But there's this extra extraordinary layer in talking about this right now, which is the tariffs that the Trump administration has imposed on Mexico. And as we're talking today, are saying will go into effect on April 2nd. That's obviously changing all the time, so we don't know how that's going to go. But let's assume that the tariffs do go into effect on April 2nd. How will that impact all this?
Yeah, so I was in Nogales the day that the tariffs did go into effect, because they were in effect for a little more than 48 hours
before
President Trump rescinded it. And I was in talking to Yoli, she was saying, you know, distributors are going to go out of business because they have to pay the 25% tariff on the fruits and vegetables, whether they're sold or not. They have to pay that cost.
Right.
So,
and they're already paying to throw away 250 million pounds a year.
Yeah. And there still are smaller, you know, distributors, exporters, and they just will go bankrupt. They won't be able to compete. So, you know, our food distribution system will become further monopolized. Only the biggest companies will survive the uncertainty and the tariffs. And, you know, it's uncertainty that leads to waste also, because the farmers in Mexico don't know what to plant or what to plan for. The distributors don't know what to plan for. Just in those 2 days that the tariffs were in place, food was diverted to Mexico City rather than crossing into the U.S. to avoid paying those tariffs costs.
You're saying there is a very high likelihood, if these tariffs went into effect, that all of a sudden we would have a lot less produce coming in, and it's hard to say where we would turn to replace it.
Yeah, I mean, we'd have a lot less choice of fruits and vegetables, and it will cost a lot more.
Yeah. Well, Melissa Del Bosque is a journalist and the co-founder of The Border Chronicle, where her reporting on Borderlands Produce Rescue appeared. Melissa, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
A judge earlier this year ruled Arizona's law banning abortions after 15 weeks is unconstitutional. That followed the passage in November of Prop 139, which enshrined abortion rights into the state constitution. Despite that, some GOP state lawmakers are pushing measures that critics say would still restrict the procedure. One would prohibit the state from giving money to any entity that performs or promotes abortions. And our next guest says actions coming from D.C. also give her pause. Dr. Jill Gibson is an obstetrician-gynecologist and abortion provider with Camelback Family Planning. She joins me. And Dr. Gibson, let's start with how you would describe right now the state of reproductive care in Arizona.
I would still characterize the state of reproductive health in Arizona as a really mixed bag. Of course, we were hugely celebratory after we had the passage of our ballot initiative, and particularly once the election was certified and our attorney general really hastily made known that, of course, the 15-week ban was unconstitutional. We were able to offer expanded access of abortion to our patients and our community. But I think we also would be remiss to not feel cautious and not feel nervous and feel some trepidation about what the future holds with the new administration that has come in. They've made it very clear that one of their top priorities is to really limit access, particularly to abortion, but also to all aspects of sexual and reproductive health care, including contraception and gender-affirming hormone therapy and care. And so I think we're really feeling, on the one hand, happy about the things that we've been able to achieve in this state, but we're also feeling nervous about what the future might hold with this new administration.
What makes you the most nervous about what the near future might hold?
I think I'm feeling very concerned about what I feel is a very dangerous action that this administration has taken, which is to really undermine basic science and basic factual information. So we as physicians and healthcare providers rely on research and literature and projects and studies that have been done and rigorously tested. And we have evidence-based medicine because of these really rigorous studies. And to have an administration come in and try and undermine that process and say that things that are based on non-science or junk science or science that has been proven false are actual treatments or actual valid options for treatments, it's just, it's really disturbing as a physician and as a scientist.
Are there particular areas where that has been the case so far that you've observed?
Yeah, I can give you one really good example for my field in particular. The CDC puts out every couple of years something called the MEC, which is the medical eligibility criteria. This helps clinicians determine what methods of contraception are safe for patients. So it basically goes through and looks at all sorts of health conditions and then stratifies each method of contraception and its safety profile for a patient with that certain disease profile or condition. This has been the Bible for anyone who is providing contraceptive care because it's so thorough and so well evidenced and really researched very well. And almost immediately after the Trump administration took office, this was removed from the CDC's website. Hmm. In addition, the STI guidelines that for treatment for sexually transmissible infections that the CDC puts out, that was also removed. In addition to a couple of other really important documents that we have relied on for decades because of the trusted information that the CDC provides.
Were you able, or was somebody able to download those or screenshot it before that data went away?
Yeah, we had a heads up that this was going to be happening. And so there were multiple, bodies, ACOG, for example, and others who quickly went into action and made copies and downloads and encouraged people who are regularly using these to download these documents. But I think it's just the idea that our government is trying to censor this reliable health information from the clinicians that need to have it to accurately take care of patients is just, disturbing beyond this precedent is something that I think is going to be extremely harmful.
What are you seeing in terms of what patients are telling you and maybe what kinds of appointments they're trying to make and what kind of information they're looking for at your place of employ?
Patients are definitely feeling anxious about access to contraception. We, especially here in Arizona, we have seen what happens when the government interferes with reproductive rights. We saw this after the Dobbs decision when we, for periods of time, extended periods of time, lost the ability to provide abortion care in the state. And so Arizonans, I think, uniquely recognize what can happen when the government is trying to make clinical decisions for them and for their communities. And, the Trump administration has not been secretive about its desire to reclassify contraception as something that's dangerous or something that shouldn't be, covered by insurance, et cetera. And patients feel very anxious about that because they have, relied on contraceptive for decades, for, 70, 80 years, we've had access to contraceptive and patients are really worried because they know how important it is for them to be able to access that, to control their lives. And so we see patients coming in and asking for the longest acting contraceptive methods that are available. Hmm. We have patients more interested in vasectomy. I've had patients asking, how many packs of birth control pills can I buy at one time? And we're seeing that same trend happen in our gender-affirming care population. They're, wanting to stockpile medications because they feel that there is a very real threat that those medications will not be available to them in the future.
How much does what happens in other states affect what happens here? I mean, obviously, different states have different laws and regulations regarding abortion, both the procedures performed in person and medication abortions. I'm curious how, what happens, not just sort of in our neighboring states, but other states around the country, does that have an impact here?
It certainly does. It's been extremely chilling to see the impact of the removal of the right to access abortion across basically the entire southern part of the United States, including, Florida and Texas. And we are seeing just many, many patients coming from those states. The lucky ones that are able to travel have the means to travel, the resources to travel. But we are seeing many patients from Texas and from Florida who are coming to Arizona to get their abortion services. And it's a strain on the system as well, right? We know that Arizona is just now building back from having a real disruption in our ability to provide abortion for the past, 2.5 years. We've been trying to rebuild our infrastructure after it was really pulled out underneath us in 2022. And so for Arizona to have to now be in an access state, a receiving state, we certainly own that responsibility, and we want more than anything to help all the patients that we can. But it is, certainly going to impact our ability, wait times, for example, to help the patients in our own community.
That is Dr. Jill Gibson, an obstetrician, gynecologist, and abortion provider with Camelback Family Planning. Dr. Gibson, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. You'd probably recognize actor Kristen Ritter from her starring role in the Netflix series Jessica Jones. Ritter has had a long and successful career as an actress, and more recently she's playing a new role, novelist. She recently published her second novel called Retreat, about a con artist named Liz. Liz lives an exhausting life, constantly assuming fake identities and trying to stay one step ahead of the people she cons out of money, priceless art, and jewelry. In the book, Liz takes a trip to Mexico, hoping to take a break from grifting. But as soon as she lands, she gets wrapped up in the most high-stakes con of her life. Ritter will be speaking about her new novel at Changing Hands Bookstore in Tempe tomorrow night. And ahead of her visit, my co-host Sam Dingman spoke to her about her creative process.
I think of the novel as one of the most character-centric forms of art. Oftentimes the novel is much more about spending time in an individual person or several individuals' heads and psyches, as much as it is about following their,
There's no more intimate medium with you and a character. I agree, 100%.
So I'm curious, as you set out to write Retreat, how literal was the connection between your character development process for somebody like Liz, the main character of Retreat, and how you would approach creating one of the characters you've played TV?
The same.
Okay.
I think it's very similar. I kind of have been saying, and it sounds like a little pompous, but I've been saying creativity first, medium second.
I love that.
It's a little obnoxious, but it feels very true because the process for me is so similar. Uh-huh. You really get in there and get under. And with Liz specifically, I wanted this character to be a role that would be so juicy to play. It's a way for me to do the thing that I love in this little bit of a different format.
Are you one of those actors who, when you're creating a character from somebody else's material that they've written, what for stage or screen, are you somebody who writes out a character history and backstory and that sort of thing?
Yes.
Is that part of your process? Oh, really? Okay.
Absolutely. I mean, my scripts will look like crime scenes. They're just covered. They are covered. Yeah. I mean, I'm filming Dexter right now, and I got to set. The director saw my script, and she was like, oh, my God. I was like, what?
Everything. She's like, can we use this for a set in the show?
it's pretty funny. But everybody says, prepare, and then throw it away. So the prep work usually for when I'm acting, it happens, way before you set foot on set. You just write pages and pages and pages, and then pretty much for, every line, I'll write what the subtext is, what the thought is, and it's usually very different than what the line is. So all of that goes into building it. And then it's kind of in your cells, and then it goes away.
Well, can I ask you if you'd be comfortable sharing, could you maybe think of some role that you've played and give us an example of some detail that you came up with about that character in this process you were just describing that people would not know about it otherwise, but that it was really important to you to have thought of and worked through.
In Jessica Jones, which is probably an example of the deepest I ever got to do, there was always like a touchstone for me that wasn't really in the script, but I kind of had just decided early, because of how Jessica Jones got her powers, she obviously really struggled with having powers. And I just decided that she has like some contempt for her powers because she lost her family to get and got those powers. And so she's walking around with the weight of the world of that on her shoulders, knowing she has to do good with them, but how she got them was so tragic. It's not huge. It doesn't change, you know, anything that we're doing, but it was just like a little thing that I felt gave her this way to see the wound. If you can find those wound windows, you love her. And that's something that I really love doing with characters who make choices that aren't necessarily like likable, like it with Liz in Retreat. That was a big thing with Liz in Retreat. I wanted to have this like con woman, but if we have her really rich backstory and see those wound windows and feel it when you're reading it, the hope was that you're going to go along with it.
One of my favorite moments in the book, Retreat, that to me speaks to what you're talking about is we meet Liz at the beginning of the book, and she is just doing this amazing job of conning people, convincing them she's not who she is, being incredibly smooth about it. She seems to experience like almost no stress in this work that she does of like convincing people she's an art dealer or an interior decorator or whatever it is to steal their money. And then you have this one scene a little bit into the book where she sits down and she's wearing a dress and it says something like, I sat down and I moved my leg, careful not to let my scar show.
And then
all of a sudden as a reader, you're like, oh, what's that about?
Also, when you're a grifter like this and you don't have people, you don't have connections, you don't have a sturdy ground to stand on, you're really like kind of floating. And I think you get up to a point in your life where that's not feeling cute anymore.
Well, in Liz, we have this character who has made a very successful career out of pretending to be other people, inventing other personas out of whole cloth, convincing the people around her so effectively that she is these other people that they trust her completely. And then taking those personas off as easily as she put them on, leaving them behind completely and moving on to the next persona that is going to help her get a little bit further ahead. And in my mind, that is somewhat similar to the work of an actor. And we also see in Liz this character who, as you alluded to, is kind of tired of having to do that all the time, exhausted of never getting to just be herself.
Yeah.
And it was tempting for me to wonder if any of that was reflective of your own relationship with acting.
It's really interesting that you made that connection because it's true. Sometimes I don't even realize how true it is, but you play these characters fully. After Jessica Jones, I found myself like unable to put on a dress, just unable to do that. And it kind of like, it sticks in your DNA and it sticks in your posture. It sticks in kind of a little bit. And then after time, it starts to fade away. You know, I think, with Liz and where we meet her, when she goes to Mexico, I don't believe that she's intending to do this.
Right.
So I think it's interesting if we're on board with Liz wanting to reset, wanting to find a new path, and all of a sudden kind of gets sucked into this wild thing that's way over her head.
Yeah.
What would happen if you were mistaken for somebody fabulous and you had a couple of days, possibly risk-free, where you could live a little life of luxury for a moment and be somebody that you're not?
Yeah. Well, Kristen Ritter is an actor and the author of the book Retreat. Kristen, thank you so much.
Thank you. I appreciate you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Lots of us look up at the night sky with wonderment, maybe wondering what's out there, or maybe wondering how humans are able to explore the universe. Well, our next guest understands that second part. Tracy Drain is a flight systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That means she helps send robotic spacecraft to explore the solar system and beyond. Drain will be presenting a show called Cosmic Adventures tonight at Mesa Arts Center as part of the National Geographic Live series. She joins me to talk about her work. And Tracy, it doesn't seem as though you're someone who, from a very young age, was looking at the stars and saying, this is what I want to do, but that you kind of came to this as you got a little older. Is that right?
Sort of halfway. I definitely was not one of those kids who always knew I wanted to be a engineer or an astronaut from the time that I was three. But through elementary school, middle school, my mom had me and my brother interested in science fiction. And so around junior year in high school is when I was starting to decide what I wanted to study in college. And I actually settled on wanting a career in space, but going through mechanical engineering as the way to get there.
What is it about space that interests you so much?
I just love that there's endless possibilities, and it really pokes at that sense of innate curiosity that a lot of humans kind of come hardwired with. And there's so many things out there that are so different from your normal experience here on Earth that it's just always fun to see what's around the next corner.
It's interesting because I can imagine, not being involved in space myself, that sort of the infinite nature of it and the lack of knowledge, frankly, about so much of it could almost be intimidating. And it sounds like you just find it, you know, infinitely, pardon the pun, fascinating.
I do. And maybe that's because I soaked so much in science fiction and then reading stories about space when I was growing up that I felt like a lot of it did become familiar over time. And so there were only some elements that were like super weird and fascinating, and you got to compare them against the things you already knew about your neighborhood solar system.
So what to you are like the best parts of your job? Like, what do you most look forward to when you get up and go to work in the morning?
There's so many good parts of my job. And my answer might surprise some people, because over the years, the thing that's become the most motivating and sort of energizing for me is just the other people that I get to work with. You might imagine that engineers are these very socially awkward ones sitting in the office all by yourself. My favorite pastime is solving puzzles, right, kind of people. But, and yes, there is some of that. And I have some of those traits myself. But I love the fact that when you sit down in a meeting full of 10, 12, 15 engineers, we're always just talking about our lives, what's going on. Someone's always cracking some kind of hilarious joke. it takes so long to develop these missions that we're on that you spend, you know, years with these people, and they come to be your friends and extended family members. And it's just a joy to get to work with a large, diverse group of people like that all the time.
What is it like to know that something that you helped design and maybe help build is going into space and is contributing to the exploration of the universe?
You know, there's so many things. What it's like, it's still surreal after almost 25 years of doing this job to know that humans are capable of doing such incredible things. And so there's this weird, almost cognitive dissonance that sometimes the day job can be a little drudge work. You know, it's not all, firing phasers all day long. But then you always have these little moments where you're deep in the weeds of trying to solve some technical problem that you need to get to work so that you can put a spacecraft in orbit around Mars, right? And that realization bubbles up to the front of your brain. You're like, wow, okay, this is still cool no matter what piece of it I'm working on. And it also fills you with this sense of pride in the human species. There are a lot of things that are awesome about humans. There are a lot of things that are kind of challenging about humans. And it's nice to get to focus on one of the awesome pieces for most of your day job.
Well, and you work in an area like, they're not, as you kind of alluded to, there are not a lot of things that a lot of people necessarily agree on at the moment. But it seems like there's still kind of this like wonderment about space. I would imagine it must be kind of an interesting experience sort of having that, as obviously not everything you do is, you know, like you said, firing phasers or, you know, looking at cool images of outer space. But the end result of pretty much everything you're doing involves something that at least a lot of people, if not most people, think is still pretty darn cool.
That's true. And that helps tremendously. one of the things about my job as a systems engineer, we work very closely with people who have specialties in a variety of areas, telecom, thermal, power, whatever. And the systems engineer's job, not just the knowing enough about the technical details to make sure we're approaching problems right and can weave them together well, but knowing enough about how to relate to people so that when we're having heated disagreements about the way to do things, you can figure out how to help people see the common ground, how to help us find a common solution to things. And I found with, you know, sometimes in the real world, there are lots of challenges and disagreements with people, that practicing that mindset and having such a cool thing that everybody can come together around to try to do, it helps. And it helps me try to figure out how to put that into practice in everyday life too.
So I want to ask you another what is it like question. And I'm curious, when you see images from spacecraft of planets or nebulas or stars or whatever it is that you're looking at, and you know that you contributed to that, like, what is that feeling like to see something that maybe nobody has ever seen before?
It's pretty great. My favorite example of that actually is one of the things I'll talk about in the show. If you've never seen an image of the North Pole of Jupiter taken through an infrared camera, which is what we did with the Juno spacecraft, it will kind of melt your mind a little bit, because you're used to Jupiter looking a certain way, and that there's no way we could have expected or guessed what it actually looks like there. And knowing that I was part of a team that helped get an instrument there to get the data back to the scientists so that they could discover that and then help explain what in the world could possibly be going on there, feels very, very good. This whole furthering the frontier of human knowledge thing is, again, it goes right back to satisfying natural human curiosity. It feels really, really good.
I can imagine. I mean, is there, I hate to boil it down to one thing, but is there like a question that you are just dying to get an answer to, space related?
Just one. Come on, Mark.
I know. It's like picking your favorite child. I apologize.
I think for me, I won't go all the way to the can there be life out there question,
yeah.
But because the Kepler mission and the TESS mission found that there are just so many planets in our galaxy, like a truly outrageous number of planets. The next most interesting question for me is, do those planets have an atmosphere? And an atmosphere combined with the size of the planet and the distance from its star, such that it could support the development of some kind of life. Those are the kinds of questions that we actually can answer. There's a proposal for a mission out there. I think the acronym is FINESSE, where it can use spectroscopy in order to look at the light from a star passing through the limb of a planet's atmosphere in order to then determine what major components make up the atmosphere. That one doesn't exist yet, but it's out there on the drawing board, and I am super excited for that in the future.
Well, that sounds really cool. All right, well, Tracy, thank you so much for the conversation. I really appreciate it.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks, Mark. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Tracy Drain is a flight systems engineer at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Her show, called Cosmic Adventures, will be tonight at Mesa Art Center as part of the National Geographic Live series. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.